It is Saturday, October 20th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and in the second half, a discussion about JavaScript, Wakanda, and a conference happening this Friday in San Jose. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Miles is a programmer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Good morning. Again.
Good morning. Mic 3, I think, today. And we also have Jürgen Fesmier. Jürgen, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Jürgen is a product manager for Wakanda, an open source JavaScript platform we'll be talking about in the second half. And you're also speaking quite a bit at the conference that I'm emceeing next week in San Jose. And we'll talk about that a lot in the second half. But first, let's do some geek news and talk about what's been happening in the week. Miles, your turn to start, sir.
Society of Automotive Engineers has decided that there is going to be a uniform standard for charging your electric car. The manufacturers have actually come to an agreement. And this is a great step forward for the electric car fleets that are out there, so that if you get, for example, a Nissan Leaf, you would be able to plug into the same place that your Chevy Volt would plug in, that you wouldn't be limited to where you could plug in depending upon what make and model of car that you had.
That makes sense. So that's one of those problems with electric initiating as a large-scale project is how do you make the standard work. Right now, there are plug-in stations for different companies and such. Has there been kind of an accepted standard before this, everybody saying this is the standard?
There has been a sort of standard, a common one that a few of the manufacturers have, but this is now a common one that they will all match onto. And let's bear in mind here that we're always here, at least talking about a dedicated connection to a car, we're talking about a 220 volt or 240, depending upon connector. So the current is always the same. The voltage is always the same. It's a question of what the connector looks like.
Right.
So even if you have an older one, I can totally see like those charging stations that if they needed to upgrading a port is so much easier than upgrading an infrastructure.
Sure. Yeah, and of course, some people that have bought electric cars have had stuff installed in their home. So that expense might be hit by the electric car owner. But of course, they're early adapters, so they like to, so they'll have to get an adapter.
But these are large plugs. I mean, these are like what you would expect from
your dryer. Right?
Well, no. The dryer actually is, what, a couple of inches diameter?
3 inches diameter?
Yeah. Talking bigger than that.
Really?
So it
looks more like you're adding fuel to your car. It's like,
yes,
like that size
exactly.
of adapter.
Yeah, so think of not so much the small pipe that's going in to your gas tank, but the rubber sheathing around that's keeping...
Why are they making it so large? I mean, it seems like... I guess you do want to deliver a lot of current, so you do need some thickness to the gauge. But it just seems to me that that's a little overdoing it. Maybe not. Maybe the idea is let's make it large enough so people pay attention and don't drive away with it plugged in.
Well, yeah, that and
I'm assuming
the whole
this,
thing is...
the car stops from doing that.
Well, yeah, we're talking about industrial purposes as well, so you want to have it a bit more robust. But the whole thing is looks similar to that gas station model where you have a pistol grip, as it were, so you're able to hold it easier and... If you have a larger target to hit, it makes it easier to get into that. You can miss a little bit and just slide it into place.
Yeah,
if you have a smaller one, fine motor control becomes a bigger issue.
Right. I get that. So you're going to waste a lot of energy by people picking up all this connector and plugging in their car. I don't know. Years ago, I remember we were talking about...
Or we're instituting an exercise regimen for everyone who...
Everybody's... Yeah,
right. Trying to make the world
I think it makes
place.
Sense to make the connector for electric cars be similar to how people fuel their cars traditionally. That does... There has... The similarities will make it feel less alien to them. I get that. Totally. So, this week on tech news, what I've been paying attention to is nothing about technology, actually, because I've been sewing. But we'll get theater geeky. Geek speaks about geekiness in general, right? So we'll do some theater geeky. I've been doing costumes for Rocky Horror in Ben Lomond, Mount Community Theater's production of Rocky Horror. And I saw it last night.
Wait, I'm sorry. Lyle?
Yeah.
Are you, in fact, a sweet transvestite?
I want to be. I just don't wear enough women's clothing, unfortunately. Or feminine clothing, I should say. Yeah, the show was a blast. It was a lot of fun. It's playing again tonight and so on. There's even a Halloween evening performance. And then next week, I think there's some late night, like 11:30 type stuff. And Miles, I know you've got a young child at home, and I suggest you get a babysitter and see it. Because it's a blast to see it. And, of course, you've played Frankenfurter, as I recall. Is that right,
Miles? I played it for quite a while, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to see
it. Like half a lifetime ago, but you know, hey.
Well, in any case, the show was a blast, and as anyone knows the music, the audience is talking back a bit, and it would be great to have you in the audience, Miles, because you actually know a lot of the secondary script. Rocky Horror has this wonderful aspect of audience participation, and so the audience knows lines to say that will add to the show. To some
right,
degree.
We would call them add-ins, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
At one time, I knew something like two or three scripts worth of add-ins. Like, I couldn't say all of them because you had to pick and choose which ones you did. And,
right.
But now I'd be lucky to get through half the show remembering the items.
Jürgen, have you ever seen Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Oh, yeah, I have.
Oh, good. Oh, cool.
Many times, yeah.
Well, maybe you have to come over to Santa Cruz and do that. Jürgen, are you living in the San Jose area?
Yeah, I live in Campbell.
Okay, cool.
Not too far away from Santa Cruz, yeah. I used to live in Santa Cruz for 7 years, so I know the area pretty well, yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad you're with us. We're sitting down off of 7th Avenue, about a block from the beach, but it's overcast today here.
Yeah.
As it always is. If you have any geek news, you know, something you piqued your interest this week, I'd love to hear it. But I'm going to go ahead and throw the table back to Miles. Get a second one, sir?
Yes. We've always been looking for exoplanets just to see one, is an Earth-like planet normal? Is it typical? What is...
Exoplanet is a planet outside of our solar system.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. And so... But at the same time, we only have one planet, our own, to be able to compare against, to say this is what life would look like on our planet. And so we have to look outside to see a sample of one is not very good. So we're looking out to see what are other types of planets. And we found super Earths around other places. We found other rocky worlds. But they've always been fairly far away. There have never been places where we can, you know, send a ship, you know, kind of send out over there and, you know, 50 years later just be like, oh, hey, this is kind of cool. You know,
right.
Nothing anywhere near that, even if we were going the speed of light.
Which we won't be.
Right, which we won't be. Well, it turns out that Alpha Centauri has an Earth-sized planet.
That's the closest star, isn't it?
Yes, indeed it is.
To ours. Nice.
The nearest star in the sky.
How many light years, couple?
Like 4.5 light years away now.
Yeah. That's pretty close.
So all you have to do is get like a half C and we can get there.
Yeah, good luck
and get
with
there
that.
Within 10 years. Yeah.
Good luck with that. What kind of, I mean, we don't have, what kind of speeds are we talking about when we are talking about our spacecraft? Like, when can you get up to 1% of light speed?
Oh, no. I think we're somewhere on the order of like 1/1000th of C.
So we're talking 30,000 years to get there.
Yeah.
<like that.
laughs> Yeah, I mean, we sent out some probes, which, like, the Pioneer and Voyager probes are the fastest moving
right.
items that have ever been created by humanity.
Right.
And
they're
let off 40 years ago, they're still just reaching the edge of our solar system, let alone interstellar
right.
space.
Not even, yeah, long ways away. So this Alpha Centauri prime planet, what's its characteristics? Does it have, it's rocky, you said, does it have a similar type of temperature as Earth? Or are we talking about an extreme file of some sort?
That I actually don't know. I have to look further into this. But let's be clear, though, that... the Centauri system, Alpha Centauri, is actually a 3-star system.
Oh, are they near each other?
It's a binary star system.
Uh-huh.
So two stars that are like our sun, and then a third, which is a red dwarf. So a smaller
And that's orbiting star. Them as well? They're all kind of clustered? Or?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
The red dwarf is orbiting the other two.
Right. So if there is a planet in there, it's complicated.
But it's actually actually, I take that back. The Earth is, or the Earth-like item, which is only 1.13 times that of Earth, so very close to our size. But it orbits at only 6 million kilometers. Now I need to do my math here. I only know it in miles. I guess it's a 150 million kilometers, I believe, is the Earth from the sun, or somewhere thereabouts. And so 6 million would be less.
Yeah. That means it's got to have a temperature that's different. But is this on the red dwarf, or is this on the binary? I mean, not sure. You didn't read this enough before going on air. But
I'm sorry. Awesome. Sorry. It is orbiting the smaller of the two stars in the binary, so Alpha Centauri B.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to be a friendly environment.
Not so much.
Not so much. But still, rocky planet is kind of cool.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like rocky as in, like, it's, I don't know. Going to the very, very hot pool. Like, everything is going to be fluid.
And molten. I mean, come on.
Well, that's fluid.
The thing that's exciting about that is that let's say we get a lot better at propulsion systems and we can get up to something like 6% C or something. I have no idea if that's even realistic in any way for physical mass.
They are talking about things like that for ion engines that
right.
take a long time to accelerate, right. but then you
but
just
if,
keep accelerating.
If potentially within 200 years or so, we could actually have a robotic craft orbiting that thing, collecting data and sending it back, which of course sending it back would take 4 years. I mean, within 300 years, knowing about another solar system seems completely feasible.
Right. Not cool. Not knowing stuff by inference, which is a lot
right.
of what we know from
right.
From
and
other
as
places,
you said, the case study we have,
observation.
The case study we have is just this solar system. About a lot, and of course, we have no idea if our star system is similar to how all other star systems have been formed. We mm-hmm. can assume it is because we keep on finding planets like we'd expect if all stars form the way.
Well,
ours
except we're
did.
Finding planets that are not like what we expect on a regular
basis.
Well,
in the sense that there's at least planetoids, right? Like at least there's planets that we at least know that
right.
aspect of it. But let's move on to another story. Today on the program, we have Jürgen Fressmeier. He's a JavaScript and Ruby developer and also the product manager for Wakanda. And Miles Elam is a programmer, political analyst.
Political analyst?
Political junkie? That's what we say, right?
Well, I'm thinking just like political hack. Like,
I can change that. I can start saying okay, political yeah. hack. Does that make you feel less superior? You are into politics, right?
Yes, but then again, I'm of the opinion that everyone is into politics. It's just the way they express it. Whereas, so I follow it in the news. Other people just kind of complain about different aspects of it.
All right,
you know, all politics are all politicians are.
Well, you have a technology
liars, you know, that type of thing.
Do you have a technology or political technology piece today? Put you on the spot.
Oh, a political one. Let's see here.
As a matter of fact,
I don't know if I do have a – oh, yes, I do have a political one. Here we
okay,
go.
Good.
The politics of Twitter are always an interesting one. We talk about on the show quite often the aspect of governments that block Twitter mm-hmm. for certain topics or altogether. And we talk about the ethics of that, where a lot of times we think of Twitter as this great democratizing agent, in other words, that – you're able to have this communication that cannot be easily controlled. And at the same time, you also have this notion of the Western nations, we don't block Twitter, you know, whereas these repressive governments, they do block Twitter. We have that narrative up.
That's yeah. definitely our narrative, that as you restrict knowledge, you're being – evil, and the U.S. government doesn't do that, right?
Right. Now,
are you going to tell us that's not true?
Well, let's look at Germany. Germany, we think of as a Western liberal nation, and at the same time, they don't allow any Nazi speech. Like, absolutely not. And for them, you look at their history, they're like, well, it's not entirely outside the realm of reason to say, yeah, maybe they're a little gun-shy. So they are actually having Twitter block a neo-Nazi group from being viewed within Germany on Twitter.
Oh, interesting.
So someone posting on Twitter and blocking that. But that raises that question of what is okay to block? Because part of the narrative has been everyone should have free speech. We should be able to have that. So, and so in that fact, the U.S. is one area where neo-Nazi speech is allowed.
Right. It's one of those things where it's one of those things where we accept that the voices we don't like, we still have to support.
Right. Right? But at the same time, we've never had a totalitarian government take over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like I said, so
what you're saying is who exactly is blocking the Nazi dialogue on Twitter in Germany? How is it being
blocked?
Germany
has requested that Twitter block it.
Directly.
Directly.
Right, because it's hard to actually filter content like that. I mean, in the sense that we talk sometimes about how China does it. Now, China does that, has this great firewall, is what we call it, right? But it's basically they have filtering systems on the outside of their network.
Well, they bought the filtering systems from U.S. companies,
right?
By and large. So let's be clear about
that. There are filtering systems for content in China. You can't really go and do a search and get the same results you get here because of that wall, but also because the organization, you know, the relationships that Chinese government has made, like, for example, with Google, to very specifically do this. So what you're saying is Germany is saying the same thing to Twitter. What's the Twitter company's response to that? How are they dealing with that? Are they going to do it?
Well, they are doing it. They have started. This was announced back in January, and now they are implementing it.
What do you think about that self-police about Nazism and saying, you know, we had such an experience of this, therefore we're going to make all this content illegal in Germany. It's definitely against the open.
I have mixed feelings about it because my layman's knowledge of the history of World War II and of the Nazis and their interactions with other members of Europe, it makes me think of, okay, I don't like this group. Like, I don't like the message, the ideology of it. And at the same time, this notion of we don't like this group and we feel we have good reasons for it to block it is exactly the same rationale that repressive governments have to say we don't like this idea, we're going to block it.
Right.
And I find an uncomfortable parallel there.
Isn't the German government deciding to make that kind of speech illegal, isn't that repressive?
There's a question, is because the Nazi Party was definitely repressive.
Yes.
So are you also talking about what is the lesser repression?
Yeah.
I'm not in a position to make a decision about that, and so I'm going to punt on making a public decision about that.
Definitely.
But
Jürgen, you have any input on this?
Yeah. I mean, I really do have several things came to mind, and one is like, we're looking at two different scenarios. One is when the Chinese government really wants to block content from Twitter, they will probably not appeal to Twitter directly. They just block it, you know, block the content or block the entire service within China. And if other countries, like you mentioned, Germany, for example, appeal to Twitter and say, like, hey, we really don't want this content, that's a different approach, right, that they can appeal to Twitter. And Twitter can say yes or no, or, you know, that's really not our terms, you know, that's not within our terms and conditions. We don't block, you know, this is about free speech and so forth. So
it's a good point.
To know more.
Yeah, that discussion between Germany and Twitter can say, you know what, no, we're not going to modify our content. And if you have it problematic, you'll have to not serve our content. Like, we will not serve to Germany if you'd like. You know, the decision can be made in that very intelligent way where Twitter can decide what their principles are and how to relate. But it also can build up this really interesting question of, can Twitter figure out rules that will work for different countries? You know,
maybe, they have.
Yeah, and how their service would be provided by different locations. It seems like a good, a good point to make a service that's robust enough to, if they decide, to filter some types of words. The thing that gets me about trying to filter out, let's say they're filtering out, you know, the word Nazi, right? It doesn't actually show up. That doesn't actually do what you want it to do, because speaking negatively or historically about the Nazi Party, not being promoting of it, but just saying this is what happened, is actually a necessity to ensure that it doesn't happen again. So the idea, and I'm sure that Germany is very good about providing the history lesson about, you know, the Nazi Party and World War II.
There's actually some mixed thoughts about how good they are at covering the history.
But I'm assuming I'm assuming it's not completely glossed over. I'm assuming that it's addressed to some degree. But if you do remove that dialogue completely, you also remove the ability to, you know, make points using that example. And it's filtering out the word does not really do it, right?
Right. And at the same time, like, what is the difference between someone analyzing it from a historical basis and talking about it apparently dispassionately,
mm-hmm.
and then someone having a fan club having to do it, which is having a fan club about it, and then you have the other one, which is we want to actually institute a political party and try to institute it.
Yes.
So you have those. I'm going to start off with those three different groups right there, and it just coming up from a podcast that I've been listening to recently. Is it okay for someone to have a fan club about Genghis Khan?
Right,
because you talk about you talk about all of the trade and the trade routes that were opened up, the communication between civilizations that were, but it was also the, you know, greatest mass murder,
right,
of that time or
any time really,
of any time really.
Well, so but the question I have about how does Twitter implement something like this, right? They clearly, if there was some twiddle hander that was representing a Nazi party, right, that was the stance of that user, and they were blocking them completely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But if I were to say, you know, it's important for us to pay attention to this, and I want to kill the conversation because if we don't, we'll turn into Nazis. Like, using that, would that phrase be removed from my Twitter feed? You know, because that's the point. That's you can't. It's not like they're going to be able to do natural language effectively, especially using, you know, short. What is 150 characters, whatever that Twitter is. So it seems to me that
You can filter information from the streams. You just subscribe to the Twitter Stream API, the Facebook Stream API, and put some pattern detection there. You can figure out who sent
type
of messages and so forth. So, and then who follows these, you know, people who disseminate, you know, who send out those messages and so forth. And
you're right away going into a problem that actually becomes really problematic. Let's say Miles is really interested in defeating the Nazi political party in the United States, right? Or this pro-Nazi political party that wants to make movement in Germany. So Miles follows that Twitter feed of those people because he's engaged in finding out how they think and therefore how he can battle it. So now Twitter makes this API and says anybody following this Nazi party gets removed. All of a sudden Miles has been removed. And Miles is exactly the kind of person that the group in Germany that's trying to block that wants to engage. So it's not a technically simple solution to suppress speech.
Yeah,
technical
solutions to social problems are always fraught with peril.
Yeah, it's almost like you need an upswell of people deciding what gets sent to Germany. But then that's a powerful point. That group would be powerful to decide what gets added and what gets not. So it's an interesting problem for Twitter. I'm hoping that they make the right decision. But I'm interested in the topic.
Well,
thank you very much.
They are making things on a case-by-case basis.
This Miles' story is about how Twitter and Germany are talking about removing the content of the Nazi Party.
Not of all the Nazi Party. It's actually this particular group that is tweeting that they are blocking for now.
It's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Although France does block anti-Semitic speech on Twitter.
France does anti-Semitic speech.
Blocks.
Yeah. And does France do it? Or does Twitter do it for France?
I believe Twitter does it for France.
Interesting. Jürgen, the company you work for, 4D, is a French company. Do you travel to France a lot, and do you see anything different there with Twitter?
I do travel to France quite a bit, and I actually don't see any difference in my feed.
Clearly, you're not following anti-Semitic content, so that's probably
right.
Why.
No ideological connection there to anything, but and it would also be very difficult to find out for you as a personal user of Twitter if there's anything different. Simply not get that tweet, I suppose.
It's important, I think, for people to understand that the content that they see online is not universal. one of my students in the grad program I work for at UCSC, Jesse Fulton, made this piece called Everyone's Google. And what he did was he made profiles of multiple users that would use Google. And those were existed in like six different locations in the world as virtual servers, basically. But they would crawl certain type of content, and Google would be tracking that potential, that fake user. And over a period of time, you could then do a search and say, I want to search for this thing, and let all those accounts do the search. And the content that was released back was slightly different, right? It's not like when you use the web, it's universal. Twitter's blocking anti-Semitic speech in France, for example. But that kind of thing happens all over the place. And the services that are being provided are trying to be intelligent about what we want. So we get different advertising, we get different feeds back. It's kind of interesting. So I think, Miles, the takeaway that's really important in the United States is that really think about what kind of content you're receiving and how the different worldview sees different content from a technical perspective, not just from a ideological perspective. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP, and Miles, do you have a geek bit today?
Yes, I do. Chaiman Shukin gave a TED Talk, and he was talking about the need for people to understand the basics of a computer, in other words, logic circuits. So even on down beyond, you know, beyond JavaScript, beyond the C libraries that are written for it, beyond the assembly language that it comes to in the assembler, even on down to the hardware where you have the NAND and NOR gates. And one of the things he's brought up, aside from him talking about why it's still relevant for people to learn and not just spend time on the highest end, which we will be talking about later, the highest end is still important, just... brings up actually a NAND to Tetris.org.
What does that mean?
So it's constructing NAND gates to act kind of like Tetris, gamification of these basic logic
basic
structures.
Units. So has he produced a game that does that?
Check it on the website. I'll have links up to it for both the TED Talk and for the NAND to Tetris.
In fact, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, we put up at geekspeak.org during the show, a little bit after the show. All the links and more information is up there anytime you'd like. Today, the geeks are Miles Elam, and he's a political junkie, but programmer. A JavaScript programmer, front-end programmer, CSS, a Java baseline, right? That's who used to code a lot of Java. Are you still doing Java?
Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of front-side stuff. You just showed me a library that I'm hoping you'll talk more about sometime on the show. That's a JavaScript and CSS solution, which is kind of cool. I'm a little bit of a programmer. I'm kind of a geek of all trades. I support digital artists up at UCSC, create digital art. And that ranges from going out on the road for a photo shoot to see how paving works. That's what I did this week. To developing electronics for robotic sculptures, to projecting in theaters, you name it, I do that at my job.
How do you end up being a little bit of a programmer after you've been programming, I know, like, with me for over 10 years?
You know, I never did my data structures. I'm really like the base level stuff. I've consumed technology by my own direction, and without a good and I've got electronics. I'm schooled in electronics. Right. And electronics, you know, I've built out structures for processors to work.
My thought process more is along the lines of, what is this dividing line between someone being a programmer versus not? I think.
What's your job title?
My personal job title is software engineer UI. Yeah.
Gee, I wonder what you do. mine's programmer analyst 3, I think. But that doesn't really. I mean, I program, but only because I want to, not because my job requires me to. Like, I go, well, the solution would be nice if I built this. And so that's the kind of thing I do. But in any case, we also have Jürgen Fesslemer. Fesslemer, thank you. Jürgen is a product manager at 4D, which used to be Miles' fourth dimension. It's a database system in the early Mac days. I don't know if you were involved in Mac, like OS 4 or so, or 7, 1984 or so.
Very talking about that in the fifth dimension.
It's
different. Sorry, that inside joke between us.
But 4D is a database and a rapid development front-end company. Kind of, you can think of some of their product line as a little bit like FileMaker, but more in the pro business area. In any case, but the product that they've been launched the last 6 months is Wakanda, and Wakanda is a full JavaScript stack that kind of operates in that same space as FileMaker does. This is not the best way to describe it, but it's hard to describe this. And Jürgen, you are the product manager for that product, and we'll be talking about that in just a second. Anything else? You also are a Ruby on Rails developer, correct?
Yeah, I have a web development background. I am a JavaScript developer, front-end and back-end. I have my own startup and use Ruby on Rails with it. and also an experiment with Node.js and Express framework. So
nice.
I'm a real geek.
Yeah, you're a real geek. So, Jürgen, what's your personal business? Your startup?
My startup was about, it was called Leica, and it was really about trusted recommendations. It was, a topic you run into every day. Like you need a good dentist. You need, look up, dentists or lawyers or professionals in general on the yellow pages, and you don't really know if you can trust them. And mm-hmm. we tried to basically come up with a solution where we can figure out how you can trust other professionals and sort of like the anxious list, but based on like your friend's network. So if, for example, you have a friend who can recommend a lawyer, that lawyer is a lot more trustable than someone from anywhere in the phone book. So
and is your business still running, or are you not doing that anymore?
No, that's on hold right now. Mm-hmm. We got funded and so forth, and we were running it for a couple of years, but at this point, it's really on hold because we haven't found the secret sauce to really make it work on a broader scale.
Right. You're listening to Geek Speak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You can learn more at geekspeak.org. Let's go ahead and go into a little bit. I mentioned Wakanda and FileMaker, and the reason I make the connection is that I'm also kind of in the dirty developer side of me. I do FileMaker development. And in the last few years, I've done a lot of Ruby on Rails and Node Play and, launched the GeekSpeak website, which is a Ruby on Rails app. And in that space, I get really used to using Git, and I get really used to understanding, I've got a story about what I'm going to add this feature, and I make a branch in Git, and then I work on that story, and then I pull that back in and merge it, and then I execute it. And there's a whole development flow that I'm very comfortable with now. And then
right.
I'm asked to make a mod on FileMaker, and I go, oh, because FileMaker, there is no source code. It's all this GUI. There's a little bit of scripting, and you could kind of pull it out, but it wouldn't really help you that much. So you're basically recompiling binaries with no source ever. And there's no way to track a story. And there's also things like to make your relationship map, it's really kind of complicated and you're doing it kind of wrong the whole time. Or at least that's how it feels as a programmer in the Ruby environment or JavaScript environment and then stepping into FileMaker. It just kind of becomes a mess. And every FileMaker app I've ever really used and worked on is kind of a mess. And so I started a new one, about 6 months ago. It's done now. And I developed it as clean as I could, and it's still, I hate it. So when I looked at this conference that's happening this coming week, I thought, whoa, that's kind of neat. So to describe how Wakanda works from a developer's perspective, like a developer would be making a FileMaker app, that kind of person that goes, well, I need a database of people and keep track of their contacts and their ticket sales or something, some simple step. What does it look like to use Wakanda, the open source framework?
Yeah. So I guess the idea behind Wakanda is really to make it as magical and easy as possible for any sort of developer, just like using 4D or FileMaker, to now write a JavaScript-based app. So Wakanda is all about web standards, HTML5, CSS. We are providing the tools, basically, to make it really easy for you to focus on your business problem, on your application you want to write, and not on all the technology around it. Like you mentioned Git, you can you don't need to worry about any jQuery if you don't want to, but we're not hiding it either. So we integrated Git, and we are integrating, we integrated jQuery and so forth. We're integrating a lot of libraries into the system. So it's open, and it's all file-based. So it's really not hidden from you as a developer. You're dealing with Java, JavaScript. Files, you check them, you commit them into Git repository.
I guess for developers, you can kind of think of it like a tool set that's similar to Apple's IDE, right? Where you use a visual tool set to build what you're doing, and then when you look at it, the files are actually, of course, text documents. You can modify it anytime. And of course, if you modify those, then the visual representation would change as well. It's that kind of space which is a little hard to work in the sense that it's not just text and it's not just a GUI. It's in between.
Right. I mean, we really provide you with this tool set where you can do your data modeling right with a data model editor, like a visual one. So they have those two-way tools that maps back to Java, JSON structures. If you're deep into JavaScript, you can do your
NoSQL data modeling right in JavaScript. If you like, then use the visual tool. Same thing goes for the WYSIWYG editor for like building your user interface. Uh-huh. You can drag and drop your components right onto a one page app, right? Space for different handsets or targets iPhone and so forth. But you don't have to use those tools. You can just dig right into the code if you wish.
Right.
And you can use frameworks like Twitter Bootstrap. Just add them to your project. And your project is not, as I said, it's not like not a binary like you would see that in FileMaker, but it's all like very similar to like a file structure in Ruby and Rails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so I recall another tool that's kind of like this, Adobe's Edge project product. I don't know if they're actually launching what it's going to be called as, but I don't know, 6 months or so I played with Adobe Edge as a beta. And one thing that's been clear for, Miles and I have been doing this show for years, and we're both developers to some degree, and I've done some Flash work in the past, that Flash system, which actually the scripting in it is the same scripting as JavaScript. It's called ActionScript, but it's based on ECMA. It's the same type of script. What we saw when people are building complex applications online is they were doing it in Flash because the tool set was there. And the entire time we've seen HTML and JavaScript and the browsers get better at supporting this, we've been saying, Flash is going to go away because these tools are that good. And you can do all those things in Flash. And all you need is, wouldn't it be great if you could access the image binary data in JavaScript? You can now. Like all the wants and desires now exist in HTML5. That's the thing that's exciting about this moniker of HTML5. It basically means, we can do what Flash does now, right? And that space has been really exciting. At the same time, what the other thing that's propelled something like Flash into this public and very usable space is that it's a drawing tool and an animation tool as well as a programming environment, right? It's both those things. And so a while ago when Edge came out, I got excited because what that is, that Adobe product, is you program, you use this interface very much that looks very much like Flash, right? It's got timelines, it has ability to draw boxes and things of that nature. You can import sprites and animate them around. But what it's actually spitting out is JavaScript, I think even using jQuery, as I recall. And the output of that is a file that I can then edit as well. Now, the back and forth was a little chunky. It was very hard. It would always rewrite those files, if you will, as you made edits. But that space of saying, tools for a human to draw and animate, that's something we're missing. And the same kind of environment doesn't exist or hasn't existed in the JavaScript application stack. If you go into Node and try to build something like a database, like a FileMaker database, the flow of doing that is very complex. You have to be a programmer at a totally different level and work with a designer as well. And that whole front-end face is extremely complicated to build. And you're kind of, with Wakanda, you're kind of addressing that programmatically. You're building that into the tool set.
Correct. And we were also focusing on business apps, the types of apps that you would build within a company or an enterprise. So like your boss asks you tomorrow, can you,
The project I recently made was a key management system, keeping track of keys.
For example, right. That's a great example because, the key management system probably doesn't have, hundreds of millions of users using it, concurrently, but it's going to be, you want to put it up on the web and so for all of your, coworkers to access it easily and so forth. So that's what Wakanda is. We're offering this tool set for building business apps with a full JavaScript stack, and we're bundling all inside. You don't need to worry about the low level details and stuff that rocket science have to worry about.
Well, I found it was interesting because you're clearly speaking to someone that the same type of slight technical person that would decide we need a little database in FileMaker and go a little more advanced than just an Excel spreadsheet, right? They want to build something that's a little more robust, a little easier to manage, that can produce reports, that can do some emailing, that kind of space. And so you're talking to a person of that nature, and that's what Wakanda's app is. You download an app and a server, and it kind of all that you run and start up all through this kind of your application. And it was at first a little frustrating for me because I'm coming from it also from the side of a JavaScript programmer and a Ruby programmer. And I'm going, where's the source? What's happening? And it is in that situation where it takes care of those things for you. I'm thinking, I've got to start up the server. I've got to find my ETC to set up Nginx to point to their port that they're running. What port are they using? You know, it was, I was looking at it at a more complicated level, and I found it a little opaque, more opaque than I wanted it to be. And after talking with you, I'm like realizing that, oh, that opacity is really there just to get people started quickly. And you're actually running probably Apache as your web server?
Oh, we build our own web server, and we, as I said, you know, we're not keeping everything, anything, you know, we're not hiding anything. So every configuration setting for the web server, for the database, that's all there in sort of, you know, form of JSON structure. You can modify those, and but you know, whatever, whenever I developed on Ruby Rails, for example, it was striking to how much levels of details you needed to understand on to get, you know, get stuff going.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. Nginx, then you had to configure it. I mean, that has been alleviated to a large extent, but with services like Heroku and so forth, where you just like push your application, you know, to the cloud. But I mean, we're really not hiding. You know, we're not hiding anything from the developer, but we're giving them a head start, basically, to, you know, just dive into.
Yeah, it's interesting. If I start a project on like on Node, my first hour is just making sure my packages are up to date and make sure that I've got, you know, everything I need to actually get it running. And that includes, you know, setting up my database and everything. And it's kind of neat to have a complete bundled install for multiple platforms where you download it and run it and you're good to go. And it's actually functional. That was kind of a pleasure. Very much actually like building out a FileMaker database, right? You just need that app. That's kind of cool. So let's talk about what's happening this coming week. I'm speaking with Jürgen Fesselmeier and Miles Elam. We're talking about JavaScript. We're also talking about Wakanda, which is an open source project. Let's talk a little bit about that being open source. 4D, a company that's been around, a database and development company that's been around for since 84 or so. It's a long time, a French-based company. I remember 4Dimension on the Mac, but I don't remember 4D, the company, until this last week or so. So it's kind of neat to see that. But you work on an open source project. Like, all the source code of Wakanda is available, probably on GitHub, and yet you're being paid by 4D. How does it benefit the corporation for you to work on an open source project like this?
How does it benefit the company?
Yeah.
To have an open source project and have me work on it, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you basically work 100% for everyone, because open source kind of defines, you know, no one owns it exactly.
Right. I mean, there are different models for open source. And first of all, yes, our source code is hosted on GitHub. You can find it on github.com/Wakanda. And that's where, you know, the database and, you know, the client framework is hosted. And we basically do not open source everything yet. So the studio, the IDE, is not open source yet.
Okay.
But, we're getting there eventually as well. And we are basically, yeah, you're right. I mean, the open source project is hosted within a company that has been around for, you know, more than 20 years.
Yeah.
But it's a completely new project with developers that contribute to that open source on GitHub. And the benefit of having, you know, product manager there is basically, you know, to really understand, you know, what web development is about in the realm of JavaScript, and what it means to make it really, you know, easy for the developer, for our end users, to you know, add the magic basically to get to deploy their apps quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So influencing that the community as well to.
And there are models like this, right? MySQL is a perfect example of it. A very large, largely used open source project and a company as well, right? There's also, I think there's a company side of WordPress, for example, right? The product itself is open source and there's a community around it and everything, but there's also companies that, you know, are WordPress as well, as a, you know, corporation as well. So this idea of kind of merging the technology, it makes a lot of sense that build everything yourself and don't see the inside means that there's no... there's not a lot of shared responsibility to make the system better. And that's one of those things you'll find when you find something wrong with an application. It's really frustrating because, of course, you normally can't modify it. And that's the whole, you know, argument of the open source community is that let's make everything modifiable to some degree. In any case, let's talk about the – Miles, do you have any questions about Wakanda, the Wakanda stack?
Not yet. I'm just listening in.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I want to develop an app in it because I want to see if it actually does that fill-in that I really want it to do of getting rid of that closed system of FileMaker. So we'll see if I can migrate in. I'll have to do a little app and talk about it in a few months when I'm finished it. But Jürgen, let's talk a little bit about JS Everywhere. One of the ways that that 4D, the company, is making this more public and promoting it is having a conference this Friday and Saturday in San Jose. You've asked me to actually MC it on Friday, so I'll be there introducing the keynote speakers and such. And we have quite a lineup of people that are going to be talking about this. Additionally, of course, it's an expensive event to run, and so some of that cost comes onto the people that are visiting. But of course, there's lunch included and stuff. And 4D has been pleasant enough to offer the listeners of GeekSpeak a code to drop the price down to like somewhere under $100. So if anyone is interested in this conference and is going to plan on going, please do go to jseverywhere.org. And if you sign up, do use the promo code GeekSpeak, one word altogether. So tell me that this you're going to be speaking a bit about Wakanda, but the other speakers are pretty pretty cool people in the JavaScript environment in general. And you're focusing this conference on JavaScript in the business world.
That's right. Yeah. Next week's conference, starting on Friday, is really a JavaScript industry event. So we're inviting more than 15 sponsors, Adobe, eBay, Google, Microsoft, and so forth. So we're also having excellent speakers that we'll talk about JavaScript in general. So this is not going to be a Wakanda conference. It's an open conference. And check us out on the jseverywhere.org.
One of them that I'm really interested in is it's called Building Spatial Web Services with MongoDB and Node.js in Less Than 30 Minutes. And Steve Citron Polsty from Red Hat will be, I guess, doing that, like building a full node location aware, which basically means using geos information in 30 minutes. So that's a kind of motivational, ooh, this is cool, how do you do it kind of thing that I kind of get addicted to. That's what I watch on YouTube, of course, is these kind of videos. So that's going to be kind of fun. MongoDB, of course, is a database structure, a NoSQL database structure. You actually have your own NoSQL system in Wakanda. And so it's neat to see the other technologies that are in line in the sense that they're in the same space as JavaScript-based server-side and database connections, but competitive, if you will, from the Wakanda stack.
What is the Wakanda storage medium?
Yeah, I've asked that on the phone. Can you tell us, Jürgen, what the Wakanda database solution is?
So it's basically also a NoSQL database. It works a little bit different from MongoDB. It's also a document-based system, but it's object-relational, basically, so you don't have to do MapReduce. Instead, you're defining your relationships like employees, companies, and so forth, as you would, for example, in Active Record in Ruby and Rails. So, except that it's not an ORM, it's not an object, relational mapping. The database is, the model, and you write the model to the database. So there's no SQL in between. So that's
basically 4D's a big difference. And 4D's, claim to fame for years is actually being a database solution. So you're using some of your database solution in that stack, right?
Right. I mean, it's the historic background is like we have been doing databases for more than 20 years, and we have a lot of experience and the data in the database 4D database is super fast, and we have been using that technology for starting. Using it for the Wakanda DB, more than 3 years ago, so we take, 4D database to the Wakanda DB, and using JavaScript, as the front end, and we have had, fantastic results, and it's a really nice user experience because you stay within the JavaScript realm, do the, dot notation, dot father dot father dot father,
is the Wakanda DB stuff open source or is that part of the closed?
Yeah, that's open source. Yeah, you can check the source out on GitHub.
So let me see if I got all of that terminology that flew past us straight. So we have MapReduce, which is taking a large collection of information, mapping to a single column or a single set of data that we're interested in, and reducing it to just that bit that we want, either like summing it or finding the biggest one or the smallest one.
Mm-hmm. So no, actually, we don't have MapReduce at all.
Oh, okay.
So So you would basically just, what you do is like you define your, what we call data class, let's say, you know, employee, and the data class has different attributes like name, email, and so forth. And also it has a relational attribute which belongs to, you know, company. So so let's say you have an employer instance at hand, and you say employer John. So John.employer or John.company, and it returns, you know, an instance of the company he works at. You can also do like John.manager or John.manager.manager if you define that relationship as this, you know, entity relationship to his manager. So it's recursive, and so you can do also the queries recursively. So you would say, you know, employee dot, you know, query, manager dot manager dot name equals Sam, and then you see the whole the structure be you know of the manager of your manager.
Okay, this is where you're skipping the object relational structure.
Yeah.
Instead of going to the relational, you're just staying as an object database.
Yeah, that's very cool. So, and that source is open. You can take a look at how they do that. And I'm assuming that's all written in C, the data section of it. If you're curious, if you understood what we're talking about in the last half an hour, you probably would enjoy the conference. The conference is coming up this Friday and Saturday. On Saturday, it's actually a lot about the Wakanda stack. So if you're interested in like using it and learning how to use it, it's a whole day of the Wakanda stack. But on Friday, it's just a general discussion about JavaScript in the professional space. This is happening in San Jose. You can learn more about it at jseverywhere.org. If you do sign up, please do use the promo code GeekSpeak. We're not actually getting any money back from that. We just want to give you an option to get a discount on the rate. And of course, you can hang out all day with me. I'll be there on Friday. And you'll be able to also hang out with Jürgen. Thank you so much, Jürgen, for being there. Miles, are you going to join us on Friday as well?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, cool. So we'll have a whole JavaScript fun day on October 26th. Learn more about at geekspeak.org or at jseverywhere.org. Jürgen, thank you so much for joining us on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care. I love meeting programmers that I get to pick their brain at later in my life, like I do to you all the time. You are listening to 88.9 KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, celebrating 40 years together here in Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay. This is GeekSpeak. You can learn more information at geekspeak.org. The guest today was Jürgen Fesselmeyer and Miles Elam, and I'm Lyle Troxell. Please do join us on geekspeak.org to find out more about the show. And maybe I'll see some of you this coming week at the JS Everywhere conference. Thanks for listening.